Welcome to the Thyroid Fixer podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy, and we're diving deep into the world of hormones, especially for all you fierce women in perimenopause and menopause, and anyone dealing with hypothyroidism. If you're struggling with weight gain, you feel like shedding those pounds is an impossible feat. If you're dealing with plummeting energy levels, gut-wrenching fatigue, or a libido that seems to have left town, then you're in the right place. And don't even get me started on the hair loss. If these symptoms are sounding all too familiar, you found your tribe. Welcome, because my goal is to educate, empower, and shake up your world. I want you to embrace every inch of that badass woman that you truly are. So if you're ready to dive in and fix things, let's get started. Are you trying to lose weight? I mean, most of us are. But when you cut calories or you use those new Beverly Hills soccer mom drug of choice for weight loss injectables, you're not going to get in enough protein. And that's the problem. That's where you start losing muscle and fat at the same time. You don't want to lose your sexy lean muscle. So Keon Aminos helps prevent muscle loss. Keon Aminos can help you feel full when you're cutting calories, which that's a bonus. And it's going to help you build that lean muscle for a faster metabolism, a lean tone, sexy body. So add in Keon Aminos. I do it every single day. I drink them during my workout, and then I'll also drink them throughout the day because that's supporting my muscles, keeping my muscles as I'm just sitting at my desk working. Add in Keon Aminos. Try them out. I love the berry. I love the mango, but you're going to love all the flavors. Toss it in your water, shake it up, drink it throughout the day. And then, like I said, definitely during a workout. So you are going to use my link to save 20% off. So that's a no-brainer for you to try these out. You're going to go to getkeon.com. That's getkeon.com/thyroid. And that is going to give you 20% off your first order. Let me know what you think. Are you finally at your wit's end where you are tired of dealing with doctor after doctor? Maybe you've spent thousands on integrative or functional practitioners that have not helped you at all because they don't know the thyroid and hormones. They're not even testing properly. So come work with myself and my team. We prescribe to all 50 states and parts of Canada. I have you covered. I've been building this team for years so that I could help you no matter where you are. All you have to do is click the link in the show notes, book a free application call. We're going to go over your current health situation, what worked, what hasn't worked, all the things. And then we will pair you up with the right program for you where we will do it all. You will come out the other side of the program, totally optimized, getting your life back. You're going to recognize the person you see in the mirror again. Doesn't that sound absolutely amazing? Well, it might sound like you don't even believe it, but I promise you, we will take good care of you. So click the link in the show notes, book a call today, and we'll be talking to you soon. Dr. Julie Taguchi, thank you so much for joining me. You are just a wealth of knowledge, and this is so needed. We were talking off camera before we started here just about how many questions I receive from my own patients, from my listeners, surrounding using hormones before they're diagnosed with breast cancer. Hopefully they won't be, but even after they've gone through some kind of cancer treatment or they are diagnosed with breast cancer. So we're going to really get in the weeds today and answer some tough questions, some burning questions that are definitely on my listeners' minds. They are thinking this, even if they haven't said it yet. So welcome to the show. And I really want to start off by hearing from you what your path was, because you started off just in oncology, you know, conventional medicine, and you've enlightened yourself. You've dove into the studies on hormones. And now you kind of, what we were talking about, you're a way out of the box thinker, integrative oncologist, because we can't just call you just integrative because you're doing things that even integrative oncologists aren't doing. So please start off with telling us more about you and really how you came into this field.
So first of all, thank you for having me and sharing our time together. I appreciate that. Well, it's really interesting. As you said, I started out in mainstream medicine, and I was really actually fortunate enough to run into a person named Susie Whaley. I don't know if you know her or know about that name, mm-hmm. but this woman lived in Santa Barbara, and she had been doing research on hormones and ovarian cancer. And so she was doing actual experiments with somebody in town and mostly using progesterone, showing that progesterone can basically kill cancer cells. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she came into my office because I had a 90-year-old gentleman with metastatic transitional cell carcinoma of the urinary bladder and the kidney. And he had moved from Louisiana to Santa Barbara to be with his daughters who were taking care of him. This man was a physician and he had every opathy you can imagine, cardiomyopathy, the neuropathy. It was amazing. And when I first met him in Santa Barbara, he already had surgery. He had partial surgery. He had chemotherapy and he had one round of radiation therapy and he was supposedly in remission. He comes to see me. I get a chest x-ray and it's the classic bullet hole chest x-ray. So when I say that, it means he had metastatic disease to the lung. His urine was bloody and he had positive cancer cell there. So that was his second recurrence. And so he said, I want hospice. But on hospice, his daughter lived next door to the researcher who was doing the work in the progesterone. And the daughter said, is there anything you can do for me, Dad? And they said, oh, we can just give him progesterone. And they did. They gave him a ton of progesterone, but they came to my office and asked me first. I said, you know, he's 90 years old. His brain is intact. He's a physician. He can write for his own progesterone. He's on hospice. I am game for that. If he wants to do that, I am happy. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, they literally gave him so much progesterone. It was like he was pregnant, I think. But 6 months later, he's still alive and he's not having any respiratory problems. The bleeding went away from the urine and we got a chest x-ray and his chest x-ray was clear. And I said, okay.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. You have my attention.
Wow. Okay. This is crazy.
And so it was really the interesting thoughts of with the hormones. And I asked a lot of my oncology colleagues what happened. And people said, oh no, he'd really had prostate cancer. Oh, you know, transitional cell is really sensitive to hormones anyway, because it's up the bladder tissue, right? But still doesn't explain what happened, right? No one's saying that progesterone killed it. So anyway, he lived another 6 months and died, I think probably of a PE because he was immobile, because it didn't fix the neuropathy or the myopathies. Mm-hmm. But and in hindsight, it makes me think that we probably should have used just massive doses of testosterone. Mm-hmm. So that's thinking about that. For a man. But anyway, so that's how I got into this. And then I started paying attention to this woman who was stalking my office with all these papers. And here, look, hormones do this, hormones do that. And I'm not kidding. We would meet and I would just challenge her. And she would say things like, why would estrogen cause cancer? Why would estrogen, the hormone that makes women women and the species propagate, why would it take you out? You want to promote the species. You want to assure that this happens. So, you know, she would tell me things like that. And I would argue back like, no, we have this study and this study and this study. And she's going with a, hello, doesn't it make sense that hormones are going to protect you and they run your life? And it took me a while, and I eventually agreed with her. Mm-hmm. And then I agreed to do this book with her, The Sex Lies of Menopause, which was basically a thesis about why women should have hormones. Mm-hmm. And it published a year after the Women's Hormone Initiative was published.
Right, which we're going to talk about as well.
Yeah. It was right on the heels of the Women's Health Initiative saying, don't take hormones, they're going to cause breast cancer.
That's what put the fear of God in physicians and in women to basically avoid hormones at all costs, because just like you said, hormones cause cancer, period, end of story. And that's fascinating, because so when you're saying Suzanne Wiley, you're talking about T.S. Wiley, right?
Sorry. Yeah.
T.S. Right. Wiley. Okay. That's how I know her as. So never met her. Definitely want to. But I have shared with my listeners that I'm currently doing rhythmic dosing right now. And I find it fascinating. I mean, and in a nutshell, all hormones, whether you're doing rhythmic or static dosing, they're going to provide a benefit. So keep going with your story. And then I'd like to transition into just kind of an overview for everyone listening. And I know it's an exhaustive list, but just kind of a brief overview of all the different protective and beneficial aspects that each one of those hormones that we can replace can provide to an individual.
Well, if I just start with estrogen, estradiol, we always have estrogen, by the way, in our system. Our bodies always make it. When you're premenopausal, you have estradiol from the ovaries. When you're postmenopausal, you have estrone from the adrenal glands. It's an androgen that turns into estrogen via fat But, you know, that's why we get probably a compensatory 10-pound weight gain. It's because we need to make more estrogen. But estrogen has like several thousands of functions in the body, like many, 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 besides the obvious. We have the obvious, oh, and it can provide sexual function, bladder, urinary incontinence, prevent urinary incontinence. It can help with your skin. It can help with cardiovascular, the elasticity of your vessels. It can help with your heart. It can help with, clearly, with your bones. And of course, at the end of the bones, we have joints. It will, you know, reduce your arthritic symptomatology. You know, there's going to be a huge microbiome effect, by the way, between pre and postmenopausal women. There's a gigantic difference between how the bugs are with and without estrogen. It's called the estrobilome. It has its own name. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can keep going, but I'm just saying there's a lot. Brain function, right? Mm-hmm. We know that there's protective, estrogen protects the brain in many different ways. There's the thalamus that there's a size, the estrogen keeps up that particular structure of the brain plump and functioning. There's also, it can reduce beta tau entanglement for the actual dementia, mm-hmm. Alzheimer's. So there's a lot.
Yeah. So many benefits. I know the list, like I said, it's exhaustive, but just giving that overview, when you start to say all the benefits of hormones, I think it piques the attention of the listener because, you know, you think estrogen, as I'm trying to remove myself from what I know. So kind of going back to when I was, you know, my teens or 20s, what did I know about estrogen? Okay, estrogen gives us boobs and it gives us hips and it has something to do with my period. And I know I don't want to be estrogen dominant and that's all I know. But to hear you actually say a laundry list, which I've said before on the show too, of all the benefits of estrogen as a replacement hormone when it starts to decline, it's huge. It's huge.
Let me just add one more thing that people don't think about, but estrogen has an influence on the mitochondria and ATP production for energy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
I think that's a big one.
That's a big one because so many people are struggling with energy, especially in perimenopause, menopause. And then you stack that with other hormone imbalances and thyroid problems. And yeah, their energy's in the toilet. And that's the one thing that they wish that they could get back in addition to losing weight and just feeling better overall. Okay, progesterone. Let's do progesterone.
So progesterone. So it's usually, it's made with estrogen and a high enough estrogen. Okay. It's produced from when the egg is popped, it produces more and more progesterone. When there's no pregnancy, then it starts to fall off. So it has to be made in conjunction with the right amount of estrogen, okay? Because only estrogen makes progesterone receptors, okay? So if you don't have enough estrogen, you don't have the right progesterone receptors, and so things may not go completely perfectly. Mm-hmm. But it does slow down smooth muscle, so then that's why you don't have the contractions. Progesterone can cause a little bit of like constipation too, because it's slowing down the intestinal movement. It is a chill, for most women, it's a chill pill, the chill hormone, and can reduce anxiety. The one thing that I always tell people who are on hormone replacement, it's really important to know that progesterone will actually block part of the estrogen receptor. And so there's women who say, oh, I'm great on estrogen, but as soon as I start the progesterone, I feel like crap. Mm-hmm. And we're back to the estrogen-progesterone balance again. There has to be enough estrogen for the progesterone to work well and to be tolerated well.
That's why we never give estrogen unopposed. Like we never just give estrogen without giving some progesterone with it, correct?
That's correct. And so you think about, you're leading me, thank you to remind me, of course, the most recent reason why we give the progestin or progesterone is to protect the uterus because estrogen will increase the lining. Unopposed estrogen or estrogen given all the time will increase the uterine lining. And over time and over years, there is a potential for uterine cancer, okay? And so we know that cycling or suppression of the lining with the progesterone or classically progestogens has reduced the issue and the incidence of uterine cancer. I want to take that thought because what I want to say is if you don't have a uterus, they say, oh, well, then you don't need progesterone. And
yep, I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
But no, because the body is so amazing. It uses that same cycle to protect all the organs in your body, including your breasts now. Okay, so if you're having estrogen and you're having unopposed estrogen for the breast for years, we know that the incidence of breast cancer can go up. And we see that in the Nurses' Health study. And after 10 years of oral Premarin, then there's a slight increase of breast cancer. So we can see that.
Mm-hmm. Progesterone on board helps, right?
Yes. In terms of, at least in the cyclical model, okay? Mm-hmm. Also, you have progesterone receptors in the brain. And the most important thing that women, I think most people don't know, is that there's progesterone receptors in the bone. And progesterone really is the bone builder. Versus estrogen can help reduce the bone loss, but man, progesterone is the builder.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. So have you ever seen women that were diagnosed with osteoporosis, osteopenia, come out of that diagnosis? They go on progesterone, they do a follow-up DEXA and or bone density scan, and all of a sudden, oh my gosh, you no longer have this issue. You've rebuilt bone.
Yep, absolutely. Wow. Actually, I'm doing a research study right now. We're trying to get NIH funding and private funding, and it's doing basically rhythmic dosing against this a patch and oral cyclical progesterone at the standard levels. And we're comparing those two hormone protocols, and bone density is the endpoint, the primary endpoint. We have a million secondary endpoints, but bone density is first. But yes, we can turn it around like nobody's business. It's really interesting.
That's amazing. That is just that is a benefit that I have not heard yet. So I'm so happy that you said that. So there's progesterone. And then finally, testosterone, which I talk about ad nauseum on here as well. It is not just a male hormone. Females need it as well. So can you go over the benefits of testosterone?
Yes. First of all, the ovaries make testosterone. Okay. The ovaries make testosterone that gets converted into estradiol as a reproductive woman. And of course, you need to, once you have popped that egg, estrogen levels go up, then drop sharply, then the testosterone levels have to go up because they eventually turn into estradiol, but they go up because you need to use that egg. So, in terms of the fertility and all of that, it's an important signal. But in the postmenopausal woman, you still make some testosterone if you have ovaries. There's always a little bit of testosterone in the background. Mm-hmm. The testosterone helps with its mental health, its bone health, its muscular, keeping your muscle mass, et cetera. So there's a lot of benefits. And besides mood and drive.
Yeah, absolutely. And protection of your muscles, because we don't want sarcopenia as we age too. That's a whole other issue. And your bones, if your bones are becoming brittle, you're not on estrogen and progesterone, now you're losing muscle as well. That's where we see the classic, I fell, I broke my hip, I was in the hospital, couldn't move, died. And it's like, you didn't die from falling down. You didn't die from even the hip fracture. But had you have the muscle to protect you, that might not have happened. Or if you had all hormones on board, might not happen like at all, because your bones would be strong.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I said muscle mass as well, also metabolism. And so there are like people who are type 2 diabetics, or people have diabetes. It's like, I really like them to be on board with the testosterone or exercising, because they can build more muscle mass. And obviously the more muscle mass that needs to be maintained, it reduces their insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. So reason to have testosterone on board.
Right. And that has a trickle effect into so many different disease states, because insulin is so inflammatory. We won't go down that path, because I want to stay in the hormone and cancer realm. But let's talk about the Women's Health Initiative study, because you were saying some amazing things off camera. I'm like, wait, we need to get this recorded. I've talked about the WHI study on here before, but the way that you broke it down is just so beautiful. And ladies, this really is, even if you've never heard of the Women's Health Initiative study, this is the starting point to why your conventional doc says, don't go on hormones. You don't need hormones. Hormones cause cancer, X, Y, Z. And this fear is still really permeating the medical community. And it still is in the minds of so many women. And I would really like to break this down and listen to you explain what exactly we found, what was done in the Women's Health Initiative study that we kind of can't use if we're talking about bioidentical hormone replacement, and then what the findings were.
I'm sure your listeners are well educated, but to review, the Women's Health Initiative was started in the early 90s as a cardiovascular study, because they had a signal that estrogen at that point in time, I want to remind you, this is only using Premarin and a progestin called medroxyprogesterone acetate. It is not, I call them drugs with hormone effects, and they are not hormones. Mm-hmm. Absolutely affect the receptors very differently. And of course, Premarin comes from a horse. We are not horses. But, you know, so there's an inflammatory aspect of the Premarin. Mm-hmm. But this study was done because there was a signal saying that showing that oral, at least oral Premarin was helping reduce cardiovascular issues. And so the Women's Health Initiative wanted to study that. And it was a great study because they studied a lot of women and we learned a lot of information, but maybe had some wrong interpretations initially. So there were two groups. One was the women who had a uterus. They were given oral Premarin and oral medroxyprogesterone acetate every day. We call that continuous combined therapy versus the placebo. Then some women didn't get anything. There was another group with women who did not have the uterus and they were given only oral Premarin against another group of placebo. So those two studies were continuously, you know, side by side going along. After 5 years, the group found a signal of there was like one more breast cancer in this group compared to the placebo out of like 5,000 women. And they were completely freaked out about that. Not freaked out, I shouldn't say that. That was their signal to stop it. That's really what they did, a pre-planned signal to stop. Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening, we heard this announcement in 2002 that breast cancer hormones increased the risk of breast cancer by 26%. Okay, 26%. So I am not kidding. When doctors heard that, they said, oh, 26, like one in four. So that means one in four women who go on hormone replacement will have breast cancer. That's what the interpretation was, but it's not. Okay. It was just a 26% increase against the placebo. And when you go back to the numbers, there were eight. It's like you did, there were eight more cancers out of that group divided by the number, total number of cancers. It would turn out to be like a quarter. So it was just that one more person was one more point or 26%. And it was like the risk was 0.4% a year if you did that. So it's like tiny, tiny risk. Now in that group that got the cancers, those people already, we know now, those people already had breast cancer,
right?
The breast cancer does not develop in years on hormone replacement. It does not happen. So it just, these were occult cancers that probably were diagnosed when the study happened.
Right.
Because women who were on placebo also got breast cancer. And when you compare the two groups, the death from breast cancers are the same 20 years later. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's another finding now that if women who are on the hormones, they might even actually live a little bit longer compared to the ones not on placebo. Mm-hmm. But the overall death rate is actually the same. So that was awesome. The problem in 2002, we had this big, huge scare that breast cancer happens from the hormone replacement. Right. One out of four women are going to get it. Like, why would you do that? You'd be crazy. But it was the statistics. Doctors didn't understand the statistics. They didn't know how studies were evaluated and why that was said like that. I mean, really, it was a major disservice to women. And when you hear Joanne Manson, who was the author of that study, she was saying, well, we didn't intend for women to, you know, people not to have hormones. They say that now. But, you know, that's what the data showed. And they had to follow that.
Right. I was going to say, haven't the authors of the study come out recently and basically kind of backpedaled, like, we're sorry. We're sorry your hormones were taken from you. Things weren't really quite right with the study in a nutshell.
Right. And they didn't know. But looking back, though, we have gained a lot of great information from that.
Talking again about the importance of getting in your protein, but it's hard to do. I get it. So I bring you a solution, Paleo Valley beef sticks. Now, when we're talking about beef sticks or jerky, there's so much out there on the market, and a lot of them will claim that their beef is grass-fed just as long as it was fed grass at some point in its life. But really, the cows are fed grains, and they're just sprinkled in some grass-fed, marketed that way. And they can say that it's American-made as long as it's packaged in America. You don't want that. Paleo Valley grass-fed beef sticks are the real deal. They are sourced from 100%. Grass-fed and grass-finished cows, never fed grains or harmful antibiotics, and they come from small family-owned farms right here in the USA, and they're good. So you want to grab some of these, add them in throughout the day, fantastic snack on the go. go to paleovalley.com/thyroid, and that's going to save you 15% off. So paleovalley.com/thyroid, thyroid, and save 15%.
But in that same study, as I was saying to you before, the Women's Health Initiative, they took women who were 50 to 80 years of age and started them on hormones with these, or drugs with hormone effects. Mm-hmm. And so women who were 60 were at least 10 years without having a period or without their hormones. And we know that without hormones, you're going to have more risks and incidence of cardiovascular disease and, you know, the coronary disease, et cetera. So what we know now is that there's this, the current, I want to say the law, is that you don't start women over 60 on hormone replacement, okay? Because women who are 50 to 59, if they took even these drugs with hormone effects, you know, anything, they had an overall cause mortality benefit. They did better. They did better. And then if you gave a woman the same drugs with hormone effects after the age of 60 and 70, they had more adverse outcomes. And it was like the benefits were not the same. Mm-hmm. So they said, oh, it's harmful to give hormones after 60, but it's based on this study. And the other one is the ELITE study. It's very similar in terms of the timing hypothesis. Are you familiar with the ELITE study?
No. What's that one?
It's a really important one that women who, they took women, they gave them oral estrogen and vaginal progesterone, and they followed their intimate thickness, and they divided it into women who were, their last period was 10 years, within 10 years or after 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so same thing, women who were within 10 years had a benefit of decreased intimal thickness of the carotid arteries. And then women who were past 10 years of menopause, they did not get that same benefit. So
do you have an issue giving women hormones or starting women on hormones over the age of 60?
I do not. And I think there's some women who need them, but mm-hmm. I do not. And I have been doing hormone replacement like this for like almost 25 years. Mm-hmm. And rhythmic dosing for 25 plus years. Mm-hmm. I've been on rhythmic dosing myself for 24. I started in 2000.
Okay.
So I was not afraid. I didn't know the data, right? We didn't have that message to our brain to not do that. So I did it. And I never saw a problem with it.
So did you start before you entered menopause? Did you start in perimenopause?
I started out at the age of 40. My story is just different because at the age of 40, I had a lot of inflammation from musculoskeletal issues. Mm-hmm. I couldn't move my neck, my shoulder. I injured my shoulder. I wasn't sleeping at night because I was in pain. I can say this now because I can see it, but I was massively inflamed. Mm-hmm. When your body is massively inflamed, when you're a reproductive woman, your body does not want to get pregnant because it's saying you cannot sustain a pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So what does it do? It shuts down your hormones. So I did a hormone evaluation when I was going through all of this, and I was in the perimenopausal range, even though I was still having periods. And it was really a secondary shutdown of the hormones. I started on some hormones. I dabbled in it because I wasn't going to do ready for rhythmic. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't getting a lot better. And then really, it was really TSY. He says, just do the damn protocol. And that was a month that changed my life. So I didn't, the pain had gone away. I was able to move. I was able to sleep. You know, my mood, everything was better in a month. So that was my come to Jesus moment. Thank you very much. So
that was super.
And I continued on it, even though I don't know if I had to or not, but I've been on it since then.
Well, I was just trying to do the math in my head, which is why I kind of prompted you. You don't look like you are 64, if I'm doing 64. The math correctly. I'm like, yeah. Oh my God, you people have to just go to YouTube to watch this, because that's why I was like, you're saying, oh, I've been on hormones for 24 years. I'm like, did you start when you were 15? Like, wait, would you? So that's amazing. Amazing. You look amazing. So this is a testament as to everything that you said hormones protect us against or with. They protect our bodies. They're also protecting your skin. and your hair and your vocal cords and how you look as well, because you look decades younger than what you actually are.
And I know my husband kept saying, if you dye your hair, Julie, you can even look 10 years younger. I said, okay.
You're like, nah, I'm rocking a little bit of gray. It's cool. It's all right.
I earned it.
It's good. So, okay. So now we have the Women's Health Initiative study coming in, scaring all these women, but they're not using bioidentical hormone replacement like you are using today, or like we are using today in the proper hormone replacement. So as we look at VHRT, and like you said, you know, T.S. Wiley came with the boxes and massive amounts of paper and studies. Do we have those studies out that back the benefits of bioidentical hormone replacement?
Not like we should. We don't. Number one reason for that is basically funding studies, because nobody makes a profit.
Right.
Except the compounding pharmacists, you know, they get paid for making their product, but no one makes any money out of it.
You can't patent it. You can't turn it into a unpronounceable drug name.
At least at this point in time. I mean, like the estradiol patches are bioidentical, but it's the patch matrix that's been patented, or it's an oral formulation that's been patented. You know, the Premarin is a semi-synthetic, so it has its own processing of how it's made. So these things aren't the ones that are patented. The bioidentical hormones actually come from plants, so like soy or yam, and they are basically, I have to say, synthesized in the sense that they're shaped into human molecules. They look like human molecules so that they fit in the receptors accurately and do its job accurately. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't have this. We have a few studies. There's a Fournier study. Some of the old studies will include bioidentical hormones. We have some, like the KEEP study was only, I think it was 3 or 4 years. They used a patch and some vaginal progesterone, not our standard of care at the moment, but they didn't use it for breast cancer. And it was only a short-term study, but it was like no harm done. Mm-hmm. And symptoms were good, et cetera. We don't have any long-term studies of bioidentical hormones.
But we have practitioners like yourself and many out there that had the anecdotal evidence. I heard one speaker at A4M say, very similar to you, she's been doing this for 30 years. And how many cases of breast cancer have they come across in practice in 30 years? She pauses, waits, she goes, zero in 30 years. So even just that data alone, no, it's not a randomized controlled clinical trial, but it's data that we can hang our hats on to say this is okay and this is actually beneficial. So now you deal with cancer. Let's start with the scenario of a woman comes to you and she's just been diagnosed. She's just been diagnosed with cancer, not on hormones. What do we do? What do you do for her?
So in my role as the cancer center, I have to do the standard of care. I think that's important because we have a ton of data on standard of care, and that's why they come, right? So I, you know, we'll tell that someone has a tumor. We have to get the information from the tumor. Is it estrogen receptor positive or negative? Progesterone receptor positive or negative? Is it HER2 positive? What grade or how aggressive? So we find this information out, and we can, at that point in time, we'll make a decision whether they need chemotherapy prior to surgery or some maybe anti-hormones before therapy or surgical therapy, or they just go straight to surgery. And then we get more data at the time of surgery. Are the nodes positive? You know, what are the margins? What's the size? And we categorize all that information and we put people into staging. One of the most important tools we have is the Oncotype DX, which it's a 21 gene assay, and it basically tells us whether or not that tumor is going to be responsive to chemotherapy and whether chemotherapy will get, you know, create a benefit for that particular disease. And it's been a huge game changer. I give much less chemotherapy in the last, it's been around for maybe 20 years. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to reduce the amount of chemotherapy. The other test that you've used, and it's totally not are supposed to be used, but the information is valuable. There is a test called the Breast Cancer Index Test by Biotheranostics. And it's really meant to be, it's placed to be done after 4 years of the, for ER positive breast cancer, after 4 years of anti-hormones. Mm-hmm. And they want to know if that particular tumor is high risk and sensitive to estrogen so that the person has 10 years, do they need 10 years of anti-estrogen versus the standard five? And that's what that test tells us. But what it actually gives us is that tumor even sensitive to estrogen or not? There is a genetic signal that says that estrogen influences the tumor. So we don't use it up front. We use it later.
On the other side. Right, later.
After women have had anti-hormones for no reason, right?
Because right.
They've suffered. I can guarantee 100% side effects.
Yeah. Yeah. From like classic tamoxifen. Yes.
Yes.
And I've known women on it. It's horrible.
And Arimidex and Anastrozole. Women can survive it. I'm not saying it's not that they not possible. 40% of the women go off of Anastrozole or the Arimidex and aromatase inhibitors. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my point being is that we overtreat the hormone, the tamoxifen and Anastrozole, because we don't have how to predict who's going to respond. That test is not meant to be given up front. And so they can't use it technically, but the information that they use at year four after 4 years of like tamoxifen is exactly the same at time zero. They use the same original tumor to tell you that, oh yeah, instead of five, you need 10. Well, could you know that at the beginning? Yes.
Yeah.
But they don't, and it's about money. And of course, if they're concerned that if you did 2 to 5 years of hormones, is that going to change your, you know, the outlook? What's the influence? So I always tell people, you know, do your 2 years of anti-estrogen therapy. And if you can't tolerate, we'll do the test. We'll do this test earlier than later. And if you can't tolerate the 2 years, we'll do it right away. We'll just get what we can get to see if you can even be on hormone replacement if you're so miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Real
hormones, right. So if someone is estrogen receptor positive or even progesterone receptor positive, do you still, is that a marker for this person cannot have estrogen, cannot have progesterone? Or what does that mean when it comes to hormone replacement with these women?
So most important thing, it took me a while to figure this out too. Gosh, normal breast tissue has estrogen and progesterone receptors on it. It's normal to have that. Mm-hmm. And we know that in oncology, that estrogen receptor, high estrogen and progesterone receptor positivity is a good thing because it is more like a breast cell versus not a breast cell and a cancer, its own individual thing. So we like having strong estrogen receptor positive and progesterone positive tumors.
Okay.
It's a bonus. It's a plus. But does that mean that you can't have estrogen? And the answer is no, but that's because the cancers, that's how the cancer presents and what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's basically the breast cell was taken over by a cancer process. And that's why I would say it was hijacked into a breast. And so, but it looks like a breast, but it's hijacking and acting like its own thing.
Okay.
Now, can estrogen influence the growth? Yes, it can about 50% of the time, but the other 50% it doesn't. And that's the 50, that's the thing that's really interesting. I am sure you've heard the stats where they say, well, if you take the anastrozole or the tamoxifen, we can reduce the risk of recurrence by 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the 50% that is sensitive to the estrogen and the other 50 is not.
Right.
That's why that marker. And we don't know what the other 50% is. It could be insulin, it could be other, you know, other growth factors and there are things that might be under our control or not under our control.
Sure. Right. Even genetics. So kind of going into the BRCA gene, even when we're looking at that, that's not prognostic. I mean, again, we can look at the extreme case. We always reference Angelina Jolie, who chopped off her breast because she had a genetic marker that came back positive and had obviously a family history. But we don't have to do that just because we have signs and signals, that doesn't mean that it's going to actually express itself. And that's certainly not a reason to avoid hormones. In fact, it might even be a reason to start on hormones because of their protective effects. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I like the way you said that. The BRCA thing, it's interesting, is that we know that if you remove your ovaries and remove your breasts, nobody has a problem giving hormone replacement. Just FYI, that's our current guidelines. Okay. removing the ovaries after childbearing makes sense because you can't detect ovarian cancer early enough to make a difference. So, you know, you can't palpate your ovaries and go, oh, yeah, I have a little mass in there. Let's evaluate it. So they remove it to reduce that. But when it comes to the breast, we have very good screening now with MRI scans, particularly for the high risk patients. Mm-hmm. And so I've had women on hormone replacement who are BRCA1 BRCA positive on hormone replacement as a postmenopausal woman. But we're, you know, they're just, I just say you have to be, your deal is you have to be responsible for the screening and any risk. Obviously you take all the risk. I'm happy to support you, but it's how you want to live your life and happy to support you in that regard.
Right. Now, I have also heard that testosterone is very breast protective. It literally protects us against cancer. Is that true as well?
Thank you. Yes, it is. It also inhibits the estrogen receptor, so it will reduce proliferation of the breast. So
hormone to throw in the mix. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've seen women who do bodybuilding and they use testosterone, right? They have no breast tissue.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
They have pecs, but they don't have breasts unless they're implants.
Right.
It's an important thing. So testosterone, back again, plug for testosterone in addition to is good.
All three. Right. So now you have someone that comes in, and this is more of what I see. They've already gone through the treatment and they've been scared off of hormones. You know, my doctor told me I can't use it. You're comfortable as an integrative oncologist, you are comfortable even after they've gone through the treatment and they've been told by, let's say, their past oncologist, no, you have to stay away from hormones. Is this your belief? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is this your belief that we can start you on hormones and possibly reduce your risk of a recurrence at that point?
I do not say that. Can't at this point in time, but because we don't have that kind of data. I have to take everybody on an individual basis and review what their risks are because every woman has their own individual risks, right? Did you have children? Did you have like early pregnancies? Did you breastfeed for years? That will reduce your risk of breast cancer. Did you gain weight at perimenopause? Did you smoke? Did you drink? Did you binge drink? Because that actually has an effect. So there's different factors. Do you have a high risk genetics? Do you have other family history that doesn't have a genetic factor? So I have to look at women once they've had cancer. I try to do the best in terms of looking at the risk of this particular tumor and this particular woman and if she wants to be on hormone replacement because quality of life, the relationship, whatever it is that they want, I have to make sure they understand their risk. And if they're willing to take the risk, I will support it. You understand? I do educate them because women who have breast cancer have a risk of recurrence. They just have it. Exactly. And I don't know what that risk, it's either 50-50 actually, right? You either do or you don't, but I don't know what it is always what it is. And when people say, oh, the cancer came back, you know, I really have to remind them, no, it never left. And that's the thing that's, I think, really striking for most people is that, oh, yeah, no, it was, you've always had it. It's now showing up again years later because what we did didn't knock out the stem cell or whatever. We just didn't, we removed the evidence, but we didn't remove the root cause.
Right, right. And I think what you just said there too is so powerful. I want to circle back to it. You listed off a long list of other behavioral and lifestyle and genetic factors that can, I don't want to say cause cancer, but that can be the root of cancer. That it's not necessarily the hormones. It could be that you've been drinking and a binger and a smoker and you have the genetics for it and everything that you just listed off. That we have to remember that as well. It's not just taking hormones or avoiding hormones that are going to determine our ultimate outcome, whether we get cancer, don't get cancer, and how that goes for us in the end. It's everything else. And I would even say that everything else is more impactful than hormones or no hormones.
Gosh, absolutely. Even the birth control pills and dense breast tissue are probably the most, when I see somebody for the first time for breast cancer, in my mind, I'm going, chick, 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 what are the risk factors for cancer for her, for this? And I can find multiple in every patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then we have to jump in and change your lifestyle. So is there anything that we did not talk about that you wanted to talk about today or that I just missed? Because this is just so fascinating. I'm kind of caught up in the discussion and I'm thinking about all the questions I get from my patients, my listeners. Is there anything that we didn't cover?
I think, let me just go with the women that are on hormone replacement. I will say that anybody who has had ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, okay, if it's been treated properly, never a problem, honestly. Those doctors are going to say, oh, you have a risk for more disease, et cetera. There's always a risk for more disease. And the biggest risk for cancer, for breast cancer, if you have boobs in the first place and you have birthdays, boobs and birthdays, the older you get, the more risk you have for cancer. You can't help it. It's just what happens.
Right.
So, you know, just understanding that. But DCIS to me, as long as it's been, and I have my own personal data collection for those women, if on rhythmic dosing after DCIS, no problem. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, early stage one, usually not a problem. But, you know, as I said, stuff, crap happens.
Right.
So can't say it's going to. In my population, I have a little mini study and I've never published it. And I should, because I didn't publish it because it wasn't as pristine and perfect like I'd like it to be.
Right.
But you know, I had about 50 women and I put them on the rhythmic dosing and they all stages up to, you know, one DCIS, 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I put them on rhythmic dosing and I realized all the estrogen negative women, not a problem. As a matter of fact, I think rhythmic dosing, it should be given to women with ER negative disease because that rhythm, I think, will keep things in line. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. My patients did not do worse than, I'm going to say that they didn't do worse than what was expected. I don't want to say they did well, but I know they did well. They did better. But right. I can't say that as a general because it's not a randomized trial.
Right. Right. So. No, you should still publish it though, because that's, again, it's unbiased data coming out that we need in the world to take the fear out of women and doctors alike, both subsets.
Yeah, one of the things I hope I'm at liberty to say this, but I knew one person in the study was an actress who died recently, who was a very big hormone promoter and even on rhythmic dosing. And she had recently died from breast cancer after having it 25 years ago. But right. People don't know, the story wasn't told. I know her story. So although I've not been treating her for all of these years, but I have been in touch with her, And, you know, she developed a second cancer. She had breast cancer. I'm just, this is an example of what crap happens, right? She had a estrogen receptor positive, PR positive, HER2 negative tumor, like the year 2000, small stage one. She had a lumpectomy radiation. They told her she was going to die because she didn't get chemo. And she said, I'll die instead. She didn't want chemo. And she was right about that. Actually, that disease was not going to help her. I mean, chemotherapy was not going to help her.
Okay.
And she was on hormones and started the rhythmic dosing after that and did very well until a couple of years ago. She developed another tumor in the radiated breast. And I know when that happens, I have seen this happen before. When that happens, it is not good. It becomes a beast. And that's what ended up taking her life. And she didn't do chemotherapy. She didn't do it. She said, I don't want it. And she was really a hardcore person to the end. She did some chemotherapy after she got into some trouble. So she used it for palliation. Mm-hmm. But the hormones didn't do that. I would say the radiation did it.
Right, right. And that brings me to really my last question for you, which is an important one. What about the whole mammogram versus thermography talk where, you know, you have this group of really functional and integrated practitioners saying, no, don't do mammograms every year because you are radiating the breast and that can actually trigger a cancer that might be sitting there and that might stay dormant for 10 years, but you just get your mammogram every single year and boom, 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 now you're activating it versus thermography, which is not radiation, not as invasive, but it doesn't pick up on as much. But then you have the subset of people that say that it picks up on more. So what is your take on the proper way that women should screen themselves?
I think it's going to depend on the person. It's going to depend on the woman because if someone has a BRCA gene, they're going to be at much higher risk than someone who doesn't. So those people deserve to have MRI screenings. Now, I have issues with MRI scans right now because they use intravenous gadolinium for their contrast, which is a heavy metal. But it is it's our gold standard, and it will find early active aggressive cancers before a mammogram. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, it becomes important. if you're talking about somebody who's older in their 70s and whatever, they're unlikely to get a very aggressive cancer. They might get the standard garden variety first cancer. I said garden variety cancer. But, you know, they could have a mammogram every 2 years or so, or intermittently, depending on how comfortable they feel. Mm-hmm. But I think the issue is when you have a problem, you need a baseline. You'd like to have a baseline mammogram to compare it with, or some kind of, if the radiologist does a mammogram, for instance, let's just say you have a lump and it's not cancer, but you have to get it evaluated. Mm-hmm. Then you have to have something to gauge it against before they start poking holes in you, or they might want to watch it again and repeat it in another 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. So having an intermittent mammogram, if we're going to do that, is, I think, if you're going to start a new process, so you're going to start hormones, get a baseline just to get it.
Right.
As an oncologist, I am not, don't ask me how often to get my mammograms, because I think it might've been about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But I have very dense breasts and my mammograms look like the color of my ceiling because you can't see anything in it. So it's like, to me, it's like worthless. And after having discussions with the radiologists, and they said, well, maybe we can find some calcification sometime. You know, I forget it. So I do the whole breast ultrasounds as my screening, and thermogram, same thing, like a mammogram. They can find smaller aggressive tumors, mm-hmm. but they're not good at finding the classic ERPR positive tumor, because those are more slow growing and less vascular. And lobular carcinoma, like, no, doesn't even get picked up.
Right. And my experience with the thermography is it showed areas of heat. And for 2 weeks, as I was then waiting for a mammogram, I got to worry. What did this show? Then I got the mammogram and I did go on for the ultrasound, because I have dense breasts and breast implants. So had the ultrasound and it was just calcifications. So nothing to worry about. But just like you said, now I have, well, number one, I wasn't thrilled with the thermogram because it just produced fear instead of a definitive anything. And I had to go get it all, a mammogram anyways. And then number two, now I have that baseline, just like you said. So yeah, it's probably been about 4 years for me too. I probably should go back and just get it checked out again. But same thing, at least I have that baseline. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to pick your brain about that, about how often we should be exposing our breasts to any kind of testing.
Well, I think the answer, the real answer is none, right? If you think about it, none.
Right.
But that's not how, you know, our medical system works. And there's still the argument that mammograms save lives and mammograms don't save lives. You know, that's the whole point. It's what the tumor is. Mammograms can help reduce your treatment, you know, treatment issues, but mm-hmm. it comes down to the person. It also comes down to the worry. Because there are people who worry and they have the narrative and they can't go without. So those people have to get it because they would not
just worry for years, right? Until they got it done and got that box checked.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, there are people who come to me and say, oh, I get mine done every 6 months. And I'm going, stop. Just stop.
Yeah.
Stop.
No, that's overkill. We can say that with confidence. That's overkill. You got to stop. Yeah, exactly. Dr. Taguchi, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your wisdom. This has been fascinating, fascinating. Your background, your knowledge, your experience is just off the charts. And this is what women need to hear. They need to hear from someone like you in the trenches who has been there, done that, treated women. I mean, the whole deal, you're walking the walk as well, taking your own hormones, and you're walking testament of it as well, like I said earlier. So can you tell people where they can connect with you? We're going to put your links in the show notes as well. But anyone that does want to connect with you, find you, what services do you offer, and how can they work with you if they're interested?
So you should know that I left the actual oncology world a couple years ago. So I'm now in private practice. Mm-hmm. And my business is called Thrivera. It's like the era of Thrive, mm-hmm. Thrivera Wellness Center. And it should be It's a Thrivera Wellness Center, and you should be able to find it. And
so you're working with everyone these days, not just cancer patients, correct?
Oh yeah, correct, correct. Yeah. So people who have not had cancer. So yeah, so I work with that population, and so I do hormone replacement. I also do a lot of navigation still for an education, because I have people who can't get in to see their doctors, or their oncologists. They don't know what their PET scans mean. They don't know how to, and I can help educate or at least calm them down until they get to their doctors, mm-hmm. or at least they're prepared to ask questions with an abnormal scan or blood work. What does it mean to ask the right questions? So I, oncology, navigation, education too.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Like I said, we will put all the links to connect with you into the show notes. And I just thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything that you just gave the audience.
Well, thank you for having me on. And I appreciate what you do too, because I'm going to be sending you a bunch of other people who have thyroid issues, because thyroid and, you know, cancer and thyroid and hormone replacement kind of go hand in hand.
They do. They do indeed. Well, thank you for that.
All right. Be well.